It was almost real. The Pro Wrestling History Podcast, episode 34. Hello and welcome to this episode of It Was Almost Real, the Pro Wrestling History Podcast. My name is Ken Zimmerman Jr., and this is the podcast dedicated to the history of professional wrestling between 1870 and 1920, although we sometimes stretch into the 1930s. In this episode, I will be discussing John the Nebraska Tigerman Pesek, who will be the subject of the next combat sports book I publish. But first, I wanted to give an update. So my cousin Dan, who normally does the podcast with me, has been battling an illness, and fortunately he's doing much better, and he's getting ready to kick out. He should be back with us on the podcast. Well, I won't say he should be. He will be back with us on the podcast for the 50th episode, which will come out on Friday, March 25th, but I will be doing this episode by myself again. And besides Dan on the next podcast, I intend to get my sons both back on the podcast, as that'll be a pretty big episode. Every time we have a milestone episode like that, I'd like to try to do something a little special for the listeners. So stay tuned in 2 weeks for that episode. And I also wanted to start off this podcast by complimenting somebody that I've been very critical of in the past for his lack of management skill when it comes to running his company, and that's Tony Khan. Tony Khan has a lot of issues with his wrestlers because of his refusal to or inability to address situations as they come up with his talent. Recently, he's done a couple of things that I have to praise him for. And the first one is that I thought that Sting's retirement was done brilliantly. Sting went out on a win, and I know a lot of people expected the Young Bucks to win that match, but I expected that Sting would go out on a win and that they would just have a tournament for the vacant tag team championship, which is what they're going to do. Tournaments aren't my favorite thing, but Tony seems to love them. And if the AEW fans like them, then more power to them. And I also wanted to compliment him for recently suspending Sammy Guevara. When I first heard that he had suspended him, I was kind of surprised, because I don't think anybody believes Guevara if you've not heard this before. Sammy Guevara was having a match on one of their television shows with Jeff Hardy. And he sets him up for what's supposed to be one of those 450 splashes from the, or 360, or how many ever times he's going to go around. But it's supposed to be one of the splashes from the corner. And on this particular one, Jeff Hardy was supposed to raise his knees and catch Guevara in the midsection. But when Guevara came over, he came over at a really odd angle, and his shin went right across Jeff Hardy's face, and they said he wasn't concussed. I don't know how he was not concussed with the way that leg came down and made contact with the head. He did have a broken nose, and you can easily find this clip on YouTube, Twitter. It's all over the place. And when I first heard that he suspended him, I thought, well, that's kind of odd, because I don't think anybody thinks he did that on purpose. It was probably reckless. And if he had been talked to about reckless behavior in the past, then I could see that. But actually, he was told to just cover Jeff Hardy and end the match. But he decided that he was going to get his finisher in and pick Jeff Hardy up and gave him the finisher, which is dangerous if he was concussed. They say now he wasn't concussed. But if he had been concussed, and I don't think anybody could tell that at that time with that hit that Jeff Hardy had taken in the head. If you pick him up and you do another blow to that head, that could get very dangerous. You know, you don't want brain bleeds or things like that from just getting in a finish. Win the match. All you got to do is cover him. You don't have to get your finisher in every time. So if he did ignore the instructions and Guevara did pick him up for the finisher, I hope he was suspended without pay, and I hope he was suspended without pay for 60 days at least, to get his attention, because what he did was not only reckless by coming down on his face with the shin, even though I'm sure it was not on purpose, But to pick him up and give him the finisher after you were told just to go home and pin him, then you are definitely deserving of the suspending you got. And hopefully it'll teach you something. And it'll teach other people that would do silly things like that. So kudos, Tony. I know I've been hard on you in the past, but I give you credit for both of those things. I'm going to jump right into the history segment this week. This might be a little shorter episode, probably closer to a half hour. I apologize if you're expecting a longer episode. It's easier for me to wax philosophical when I've got somebody to bounce things off of. But my challenge there, as you will see if you tune in for episode 50, is that sometimes it's very hard to rein Dan and my sons in. And since Dan has had a month now to watch the news and get irritated about things, I'm sure that he is going to have both cannons blazing on the next episode. So that'll probably be interesting in itself. I promise you I will shoehorn some history in there, though, no matter how much they get going. And I might even share my thoughts on this whole surge pricing idea at fast food restaurants. But we'll save that all for the next episode, and I'll jump right into the history. As I've said in previous podcasts, I started researching the time frame of 1870 to 1920 because I had believed at one time that there was a time in professional wrestling where it was legitimate contests, and eventually the sport evolved into a worked or a prearranged exhibition. And that's not quite how I would say that pro wrestling evolved. Yes, the wrestling matches in the 19th century, probably in most of them, let's not say the majority, let's say most of them were legitimate contests. But there have been worked matches going on as far back as I've researched wrestling. So going back to 1870, the earliest matches, I'm really hoping to find some matches from the 1860s in the next couple years as more and more resources become available. But going back to the earliest matches of the 1870s, wrestlers worked matches. Well, the most of them in the 19th century were still contests. And then you have a transition period in 1900 to 1950 where more and more matches are becoming worked. And then after around 1915, although it's important to know that's not a hard date, because there were still legitimate contests going on in the late teens. Lewis and Stecker had their last contest, I think, in 1917, which Lewis finally won. The Stecker-Caddick match in 1917, where Caddick won the world title, that might have been a contest as well. My subject today, John the Nebraska Tigerman Pesek, was still wrestling contests in Nebraska in the late teens. So there's no hard date where wrestling was legitimate or it became a prearranged exhibition. It's all kind of fuzzy, just like professional wrestling tends to be kind of fuzzy. That's also the reason that I named the podcast It Was Almost Real, because there's never been a time when professional wrestling was 100% legitimate contests. But please never say fake, because while the match is prearranged or predetermined, injuries are real, it's still dangerous, and people still get hurt. Particularly back in the era that I look at, because the majority of the wrestlers there did know how to wrestle. Even though that they were working their matches in front of people, they would test each other in training matches in the gym. And that's also how they kept sharp in case somebody tried to double-cross them, because after around 1915, the late 19-teens, by the time you get into the 1920s, legitimate contests are normally one of two things. It is a double cross that is perpetrated by one of the legitimate wrestlers, or it is a legitimate contest agreed upon beforehand, and most of the time those were to settle promotional wars. The 1928 match between Lewis and Stecker was a legitimate contest agreed upon to settle the divided world championship and the promotional war that had been going on between Stecker and his camp and Lewis and his camp. The little caveat on that match is it started out as a contest, but about halfway through the two-hour match, not halfway through the two-hour match, at about the two-hour mark of the match, Stecker realized he couldn't beat Lewis, and they kind of had they made a gentleman's agreement in the ring. Lewis won the first fall. They discussed it in a long intermission between the first and the second fall. Lewis let Stecker take the second fall, and then Lewis won the third fall. But Lewis never gave Stecker the opportunity to double-cross him after they had that agreement. He still kept back so Stecker couldn't take him down, and he never put himself in a vulnerable position like using his headlock. So he still didn't trust that something wouldn't occur, but that was a match that started out as a shoot and ended as a work. John, the Nebraska Tiger Man Pesek, attracted my attention because he was someone promoters used to settle two promotional wars in the 1920s. In the early 1920s, Tex Rickard, one of the most famous boxing promoters of all time, he promoted boxing's first $1 million gate with Jack Dempsey, and he had the exclusive rights to promote sporting events at Madison Square Garden. And he and Jack Curley had promoted a boxing event in Madison Square Garden. Jack Curley, by the late teens, is the regular New York City promoter. He does not have the right to promote in Madison Square Garden without Tex Rickard's assistance, but the two of them have a working relationship at first. Rickard's helping Curley on the wrestling side by letting him in Madison Square Garden. Rickard's returning the favor by giving Curley an opportunity to get in on the boxing cards that he's promoting, which are normally very, very profitable. But in the early 1920s, Rickard does promote a card that loses money. And that card, Curley was his one of his partners and also lost money in it. And Jack Curley did not like losing money. So he got furious with Rickard, and because he had a bad temper, he ended their partnership, which also froze him out of promoting wrestling at Madison Square Garden. Well, Rickard has just as big an ego as Curley, and he doesn't like how Curley is acting. So he decides that he is going to promote his own wrestling in Madison Square Garden. But to do this, he needs to sign a wrestler who's a legitimate shooter hooker. A shooter is somebody that can wrestle extremely, extremely well. A hooker is someone who's really good with hooks, submission holds, which are joints. I'm sorry, chokes, joint locks, etc. He signs Marin Plastina, who is one of Martin Farmer Burns' students, who is a shooter and a hooker. And Plastina has been furious since 1917 at Joe Stecker over a match that they had, and he's been pretty much frozen out of wrestling for the world title controlled by Jack Curley because he made Curley and his promotional partners mad with how he reacted in the Stecker bout, and because he didn't want to go along with prearranged finishes, he wanted to wrestle his matches legitimately. Curley at first just ignores the challenges from Plastina because he does not want to give Rickard any credibility. I think for 3 years they were making these challenges, and the promotional group headed by Curley would just ignore them. Finally, in 1921, he could not ignore the challenges anymore. He doesn't want to risk Lewis against Plastina, even though Lewis could have probably beaten him. Lewis believed he could beat him, but they didn't want to risk putting a champion in there. Anything can happen in a contest. If Lewis blew out a knee or something like that, he could lose just because he got injured, even though it would be a fluke injury. I'm not talking about Plastina hooking him. I'm just talking about he's wrestling him, something happens, he can't defend himself. Those kind of things can happen in a contest. So instead of risking Lewis, they decide to match Plastina with John the Nebraska Tiger Man Pesek. Pesek successfully fends off the challenge from Rickard and makes Plastina look so bad that Rickard gets out of the wrestling promotion business and doesn't try to challenge Curly in New York anymore. There's a lot more details to it than that, but I've got a blog post on the website, and I cover it much more extensively in this book I'm writing right now. Pesek sends Plastina's challenge off and makes Plastina look so bad in the process that Plastina falls in line eventually and gets back in with the dominant promotional group. 2 years later, Lewis is the world champion in 1924. But the Goldust Trio has been kind of pushing Curly to the side because they're tired of being told what to do. Curly was dominating the trust from the late teens to the early 20s and was kind of dictating who was going to be world champion. When Lewis won the world championship back in 1922, the Goldust Trio starts setting up promoters all throughout the United States, and Lewis really doesn't need to wrestle in New York because he can make as much money wrestling in Chicago and Kansas City and Omaha as he can by wrestling in New York City, where pro wrestling is not as big as it is in the Midwest. Curly decides he doesn't like being aced out, so he gets Nat Pendleton, who, I'm doing this off the top of my head, so forgive me, I'm probably going to get the school wrong, but I think that he was a college wrestler for Cornell University. It's somewhere up in the Northeast, and for some reason Cornell is the school that's popping into my head, but I could be completely wrong on that. If I am, I will correct it in the next podcast episode. And he was also an Olympic silver medalist and should have won the gold medal in the 1924 Olympics, except that there was a funny judge's decision and everybody knew Pat Pendleton had been ripped off. So Curly convinces Pendleton to start wrestling professionally, and he puts Pendleton in a legitimate contest because nobody's going to beat Nat Pendleton. You're going to have to be a really, really skilled professional wrestler. So Pendleton beats a bunch of guys in a row, and Curly keeps challenging Lewis in the papers. And eventually the Goldust Trio realize they're going to have to do something because Lewis is really being made to look like he's ducking this challenge from Pendleton. And so the Goldust Trio agree that if Pendleton can defeat John the Nebraska Tiger Man Pesek, that Lewis will give Pendleton the title shot Pendleton wants. So this is a huge risk for the Goldust Trio, because going into that match, Pendleton is definitely favored over Pesek. Pesek is a great pro and a great hooker. He is a very skilled submission wrestler that can catch Pendleton with a choke or a arm lock. But Pendleton's wrestling pedigree is so great that getting him into a position for one of those holds will be very, very difficult. So in boxing, when you have a really strong power puncher going up against a very slick, skilled boxer, they call that scenario a puncher's chance. The skilled, slick boxer is going to be favored, but he does have a puncher's chance, meaning he might be able to get one of those power shots on the chin of that slick boxer and knock him out and win the fight. If he cannot do that, he is going to lose. You basically had that exact same scenario with Pesek versus Pendleton. Pendleton is so far ahead of Pesek as a shooter, as a skilled professional wrestler, it's very unlikely Pesek's going to be able to take Pendleton down, and it'll be very unlikely that he could get Pendleton in position for a hook. But if he can, he has a hooker's chance in this match. If he can catch Pendleton in one of those chokes or joint locks, He might not only be able to win the fall, but he might be able to hurt Pendleton enough that he could win the match. But he definitely would not have been favored going into that match. The Goldust Trio was taking a big risk, but it also shows they had a lot of faith in Pendleton's ability, because they didn't send Joseph Tootsmont out there to wrestle Pendleton, even though Lewis said Mont was the only hooker on his level. They sent Pesek out, which means they had more faith in Pesek to be able to beat Pendleton than Mont. And it turned out to be a very wise decision, because Pesek did fulfill the hooker's chance, and he was able to catch Pendleton. Shocked everybody, including Curly, when he won that match. So Pesek was the wrestler used by two different factions to settle two promotional wars. So I found it very, very odd for this excerpt that was in Luthez's book, Hooker, which it was available on Amazon the last time I looked. If you've not read Hooker by Luthez, you really should. It is a great book about wrestling before the territory era and the beginning of the NWA era. And it really bridges the gap between the really early 1920s, 19-teens professional wrestling scene and the television era, where Thez really came into his zenith. So in Thez's book, he writes about Pesek. Ed Lewis, who knew him well because he used Pesek as a policeman for a while in the 1920s, said John was a great, great wrestler who simply didn't like a straight-up contest. He had no qualms about hurting guys who couldn't give him a problem, said Ed. But his heart would go into his backside, I'd clean that up for the audience, when he was faced with real competition. It was a strange thing to see, because Pesek could really go, and Ed came to believe Pesek was simply scared of getting beat in public and how it would affect his reputation with the fans. Once he was supposed to have a contest with Jim Landis, and this was true, who wasn't in Pesek's league, but Ed said Pesek was nervous about it and canceled a couple days before the match. Ed said, I wanted to see him beat Landis, and he could have done it too, so I was angry with him when he canceled. I confronted him about it, and Pesek said he'd had to cancel because he'd been injured when he fell off a horse. I told him, you yellow bohunk, if you'd waited another day, it would have been Landis who fell off the horse. I really struggled with that characterization of Pesek based on his contests with both Plastina, who was no scrub at all in the ring, and Pendleton, who was a great, great wrestler, one of the best wrestlers produced in that era. That's why I started this research project. And I already believe that I've got enough information to disprove that characterization of Pesek. Lewis came to believe that Pesek didn't want to look bad in front of the other wrestlers, which is why he would avoid the straight-up contests. But I have numerous records of him wrestling contests against other wrestlers and the two promotional wars that he settled in legitimate contests. We'll study and see if we come up with any other reasons why Lewis might have felt the way he did. The match that Lewis was talking about, Pesek did cancel a match in, I think it was 1930, with Landis, and he said he fell off his horse. And I guess that they were supposed to wrestle a legitimate contest. And Landis was in no way on the level of Pesek as a shooter and a hooker. Yes, Landis had learned to hook at the carnivals, but he was several levels below Lewis, Stecker, Mont, Pesek. He was not in any of those guys' league. So there's no way he could have beat Pesek in a contest. But there would be lots of reasons for Pesek not to want to wrestle Landis in a contest. Number one, Landis was the biggest box office star in professional wrestling in the 1930s. He could draw 30,000 fans to baseball stadiums in New York and Chicago. Pesek would not have had any reason to risk going into the ring with Landis, having a contest and beating him or hurting him or making him look bad and making an enemy of Landis, who would remember that and not let him wrestle any of those big matches where Pesek could have drawn the most money. So that's one explanation for why Pesek could have said, no, I fell off my horse, I can't, you know, wrestle that match. I just don't buy the fact that he was scared of looking bad in front of the other wrestlers. Maybe my opinion will change in the next 3 months as I finish researching the book, but I don't really think so. So that is John the Nebraska Tigerman Pesek, two of his most famous contests. He wrestled others that we're going to discuss in the book. And he's probably most famous for double-crossing his good friend Joe Stecker in a 1926 world title match that turned out to be extremely controversial, because it's probably the first time that someone made the champion submit in the ring, but the referee just blatantly disqualified the challenger to keep the title on the champion and almost caused a riot in the process. So maybe we'll cover that in a future episode. But my next book will be on John the Nebraska Tigerman Pesek, and I hope what we've talked about today will pique your interest a little bit to see him as a wrestler, a businessman, and a brother. He had two younger brothers who also wrestled, who he got into professional wrestling. I didn't really have much for the review this week. Well, I do, but I want to save it for the next episode. I found about a 5-minute highlight reel from Jim Landis versus Cola Cariani when he was, and I know I butchered the last name for Cola Cariani, but they wrestled in a stadium in Athens, Greece. They estimated it was between 70 to 100,000 people. It looks like a lot closer to 100,000 people to me. And we're going to talk about that match when Dan and the boys join me for the next podcast, which will be episode 50. And so I didn't have anything I really wanted to review other than that. I've been watching some of the old territory stuff of the 70s and the 80s. And I will say, we do tend to look at wrestling from that era with rose-colored glasses, because there was a lot of bad wrestling going on in the 70s and the 80s. Not necessarily with the major promotions like Mid-Atlantic, you know, Crockett Promotions. Georgia was hot. Florida was hot. Portland wasn't particularly hot. AWA was already starting to show some age a little bit. Bruiser's territory was really aging out. And you had a lot of stuff that wasn't all that great. So yeah, there was some great stuff. Now, I don't think Mid-South was even Mid-South yet. I think it was still Tri-State, primarily the product of Leroy McGurk. And it was nothing compared to what Bill Watts would make it into a few years later. So we do tend to look at the wrestling that we grew up on and liked through rose-colored glasses, but when you look at it later, it doesn't hold up as much. But I talked long enough that I remembered the match I do want to recommend. It is available on YouTube, and it is the 1977 match from Dallas, or probably Fort Worth. Yeah, I think it was Fort Worth, between Harley Race and David Von Erich. David Von Erich is 19 or 20 in this video. He was the Rookie of the Year that year. Harley's obviously calling this, generaling it, but you could already see that David is going to be a big, big star. And had he not died so tragically young, he would have been very fondly remembered today. He would have been an NWA world champion. He might have kept world class going a little bit longer than it did. And he would have been a big star for one of the two major companies because he had the best mind for professional wrestling. So I recommend that match. I will put a link for it in the show notes. You can check out the show notes for any episode at KenZimmermanJr.com/episode and whatever the episode number is. For this one, it'll be KenZimmermanJr.com/episode49. And I will have the link for that match in the show notes. And as I promised you, it's going to be a shorter episode this week. It might be a pretty long one next time, so you might want to enjoy the shorter episode this week. Next week, we will not have an episode. That's the break week. And then we will be back for the last Monday of the month, which I believe is March 25th. And in fact, I know it's March 25th. And we'll have the whole gang together for that. If you love or if you like the podcast, love might be a little stronger, but if you like the podcast, we'd appreciate a rating on whatever podcast app that you listen to us on. That helps the podcast become visible and it helps more people to find it. And until next time, take care, everybody. Bye-bye.